to another edition of Word Magazine. This is Jeff Riddle, pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia. And this is episode number 73, in which we're going to be looking at the coherence-based genealogical method, which has been applied to the modern critical text. Yes, I am alive. It's been a while since I've done a Word Magazine. I think Word Magazine 72 was done back in the first week in March. In the meantime, I was out in Seattle for a couple of weeks, had the privilege of preaching at Emmanuel Reformed Baptist Church in SeaTac, and just got to spend some time with my wife and my two youngest sons, doing some sightseeing, had a wonderful time in Seattle. Beautiful, absolutely beautiful in the Pacific Northwest. Never been to that part of the country before, but gorgeous place. Saw a lot of interesting things, had a lot of interesting ideas, but didn't have much time for blogging or doing Word magazines. But I'm noticing that anecdotes from the Seattle trip are showing up as illustrations in my sermons since I've gotten back. And I've been teaching a couple classes, college classes, doing my pastoral ministry, and those who know me know that spring for me also means the beginning of baseball season, and I'm coaching my two boys, younger boys, in baseball this year. It's been a rough start for us. We are the two-time defending champs in our league at our ballpark, and we started off the season losing our first two games. We tied. We don't play extra innings for the regular season. We do in the playoffs. In fact, we won the championship last year in the eighth inning. We were, for this age group, 11 and 12 year olds, you normally play a six inning game. But in the regular season, if it ends after six and a tie, it's just a tie. So my team is no wins, two losses, one tie. So anyway, it's been busy with lots of things. But sometime back, several people asked me if I would do a Word Magazine on the coherence-based genealogical method. The impetus for this, I think, was a podcast, Reformed Forum podcast, that aired on February the 10th of 2017. This was an interview with a young scholar, Peter J. Gurry, on the an article that he had published in JETS, the Journal of the Evangelical Theological Society, back in 2016, on how your Greek New Testament is changing. And again, several people asked if I would give sort of a confessional text, a Textus Receptus response to this. And it is a very complicated topic, and it's one that I don't claim to be an expert in. I'm not a practitioner of the coherence-based genealogical method, but it's something I've been wanting to look at more closely. And I had actually downloaded Gurry's article a long time ago. It's available on the website, his site at academia.edu. So anyways, I thought that I would do a Word Magazine sort of giving some responses, reaction from a traditional text or a confessional text perspective on some of the things that Gurry said about the coherence-based genealogical method, the CBGM, which is a major development in the history of the modern critical text. A really significant sea change is taking place right now in the academic study of the text of the Greek New Testament, and the CBGM is at the heart of this and will have implications for the next couple of decades and probably beyond. And I think a lot of people are not aware of what's going on. A lot of people who, evangelicals, even Reformed, confessionally Reformed people who have embraced the modern critical text, I think a lot of them are really not aware of what's happening with the modern critical text and how it's changing, and how the persons who are the gatekeepers, the custodians of the modern critical text, what they are doing to it, already have done, and what they plan to do in the future. Even a lot of people who have PhDs in New Testament. Text criticism is a very technical field, and if you were more interested in looking at theology or history in the study of the New Testament, or the literary aspects of the New Testament, as opposed to the texts and the manuscripts and so forth. I think a lot of people who are even credentialed academic scholars aren't completely aware of what's happening with the modern critical text. So I thought about several ways to do this. I thought about just playing the Reform Forum episode and starting and stopping and giving responses. And I thought that I think that might be tedious. Instead, I'm just going to talk through some more general ideas about the coherence-based genealogical method. I'm going to give a little brief description of it, and then I'm going to talk about some of what I think are actually positive aspects of this development with regard to the confessional text, with regard to the defense of the confessional text. And then I'm going to talk about what I see as some of the weaknesses of this view with regard to the confessional text. Interestingly enough, I had some contact recently with Peter J. Gurry. He's a really nice young man. We wouldn't agree on our views on the text of the Bible. He is, I guess, a reasoned, eclectic text person. He is an advocate for the modern critical text, but he's a really nice young man. He is a recent graduate of Fitzwilliam College, University of Cambridge, did a PhD in New Testament, and his specialty was in text criticism. And as I understand it, he did his dissertation on understanding the coherence-based genealogical method. So he's one of the foremost interpreters of this method to the English-speaking world. Because as we'll see, it's primarily a method that's been developed in Germany. So Gurry is certainly one of the foremost explainers, popularizers, interpreters now for the English-speaking world of this method. And he's actually recently been hired to teach at Phoenix Seminary, the same seminary out in Arizona where Wayne Grudem is. He's an assistant professor now of New Testament there. And as Providence would have it, back in early March, I was at the theology conference at Houston Baptist University. And I did a paper on the ending of Mark as a canonical crisis. And Peter Gurry wasn't there, but one of his colleagues, John Mead, who is an Old Testament professor at Phoenix, was there, did a very good paper. He's writing actually a book for Oxford University Press on canon, issues related to canon. And I had a lot of several conversations with John Mead while I was out in Houston, sort of picking his brain. He's not, he's got a respect for the Masoretic text. However, would want to have some readings, I think, in, if I'm not, don't think I'm misrepresenting him, some readings in the Old Testament taken from the Septuagint. So we wouldn't agree about that. But I think he had a lot of good things to say about a healthy respect for the Masoretic text. And we, he's a very knowledgeable person. So I enjoyed talking with him. But through him, then Peter Gurry heard about my paper and he contacted me. I shared my paper with him on the ending of Mark as a canonical crisis, and we had some back and forth on it. And I found out that he actually, although he doesn't believe that the ending of Mark is original to the Gospel of Mark, he believes that it is canonical and he believes that it is inspired. So his position is sort of like that of Bruce Metzger in his book on the canon of the Bible. He says that he doesn't think the ending of Mark is original, but he believes it's canonical. I don't know that what Metzger would have said inspired, but Gurry is more of an evangelical, so he thinks it's canonical and inspired. So, and Gurry regularly contributes to the Evangelical Text Criticism blog, and he pointed me to a blog that he did there on the ending of Mark, where he expressed some of his views, and he cites this as also the view of Samuel Tregelis. Anyways, we had a back and forth about that, and then right after that, I actually told him in the email, I really want to get to reading your article on the CBGM, and thank you for doing it, and so forth. And so then, not long after that, there was the Reform Forum podcast, and then a couple people asking me to give a response. And so that's what I'm going to do today, if I can ever get to it. Let me just say, by the way, about the Houston Baptist Conference. Last year in 2016, I did a paper there on John Calvin and text criticism, and I just got the proofs back for that. I took that paper presentation and refined it a little bit and submitted it to Puritan Reform Journal. And it's going to be coming out in the July 2017 issue. And so this is, of course, a much more expanded edition than the paper that I gave in Houston. And there's actually an audio recording at sermonaudio.com of the 20 or 25 minute presentation as I gave it in Houston. The paper, again, is a lot more detailed. It's about 20 pages in length. Once the journal comes out in July, I will be posting the article to academia.edu, and I'll have a blog post about it for those of you who might be interested in reading that article on John Calvin and text criticism. Also, I've submitted the paper, an article version of the paper I did this year, The Ending of Mark is a Canonical Crisis, for publication. I'm waiting to hear. Submit it to one journal, and if it doesn't get accepted by that journal, I'll be submitting it to another. So hopefully that one will also be printed at some point in the future. All right, let me get down to this. Looking at the coherence-based genealogical method, again, Peter Gurry's article in JETS was titled "How Your Greek New Testament is Changing, A Simple Introduction to the Coherence-Based Genealogical Method, CBGM. And I know he meant it to be a simple introduction, but a pastor friend of mine emailed me and said that he had tried to read this article, and he read it and reread it and just couldn't understand what the CBGM was about. It is a very technical topic, a very technical subject, and so I'm going to try not to get too deeply in the weeds on it, but I'm going to just speak, give you a general idea about it, and more importantly, why it's significant. I think this is the key issue, why this is significant, and why it presents, I think, some pragmatic and doctrinal problems for those who have embraced the modern critical text. So, I hate to keep giving these asides, but by the way, I will have a blog on my blog, jeffriddle.net, for Word Magazine 17. I will have the notes for the overview I'm going to be giving you. And this is important. At the very end of the overview, I'm also going to have some resources, and I'm going to list links. I'm going to have a link to Peter Gurry's article, How Your Greek New Testament is Changing. I'll have a link to the Reformed Forum episode from February 10th. I'll have a link to Peter Gurry's blog post on the ending of Mark that I have already referred to. I'll have a link to another article that mentions the coherence-based genealogical method by Greg Lanier, and several links as well to pages from the German Bible Society that are specifically about either the Editio Critica Maior or the coherence-based genealogical method. So anyways, if you're really interested in this, I'd encourage you to go to the blog article that I'll have up on this, and you can read the primary sources yourself instead of relying just on my overview of it. So let's start off with an introduction. What is the coherence-based genealogical method, the CBGM? Again, this is a very simplified presentation. It is a new approach in modern text criticism, which makes use of sophisticated computer technology and databases to provide study and analysis of the witnesses to the New Testament and their relationship to each other based on comparison of these witnesses and the variance that exists within these witnesses. So it's a computer-based method. One of the links that I'll give you on my blog post are some of the things that are provided by the German Bible Society. There's a genealogical queries page where you can experiment a little bit with the method yourself. The version 1.0 was put up in 2008, and a version 2.0 was put up in 2013. I'll have links to both of those if you're interested in it. So again, this is a new method, computer-based method for studying and analyzing the witnesses to the New Testament. It was developed primarily by a German scholar named Gerd, might be pronounced Gerd Mink, M-I-N-K, and other scholars at the Institute for New Testament Research at the University of Münster in Germany. And this Institute for New Testament Research, founded by Kurt Aland, is really the epicenter of the academic study of the Greek New Testament. This is the place where the official catalogs are kept of the manuscript. This is the place that assigns number designations and classifications to manuscripts as they are discovered. This is the place that is responsible for editing the Nesselaland handbook. So this is really the epicenter. The epicenter of the academic study of the Greek New Testament is not in the English-speaking world. It's certainly not in the evangelical world. It's not in the Reformed world. It is this think tank or this institute that is in a secular German university, the University of Münster in Germany. And there's been an interesting thing that's been going on there the last couple of decades that is probably something, again, that most people, even especially people who have embraced the modern critical texts, are not aware of. And that is, there's a project. They have been working on the publication of what is called the Editio Critica Maior, the Greater Critical Edition. And it's known by the abbreviation ECM. And so what this is a major revision of the modern critical Greek text. And it is intended eventually to update and replace the modern critical Greek text that now underlies the text that is printed in the popular handbook. Now, what do I mean by that? If you go to Bible college or seminary and you want to study Greek, New Testament Greek, even if you go to, let's say you're non-religious and you go to a secular university, University of Virginia or whatever, and you want to study Hellenistic Greek and you want to do readings from the New Testament, generally there are two handbook editions of the New Testament that are printed. One of these is popularly referred to as the Blue Book, the Blue Covered Book. And this is the Nessel-Aland handbook that is printed by the German Bible Society. And the most recent edition of this is the Nessel-Aland 28th edition, which was published in 2012. So this is the most recent edition of the German Bible Society handbook. The second one that is used is the brown cover edition, as it's popularly known, because obviously it's printed with a brown cover. And this is the one that's published by the United Bible Societies. And it's now in its fifth edition. And the thing about it is, both the Nessel-Aland 28 and the UBS fifth edition, they're exactly the same text, of the New Testament. The only difference is the front matter, the introductory articles and prefaces, and the apparatus in each handbook is different. I personally prefer the Nessel-Aland. The apparatus is much more detailed. It's a really a masterpiece in communication of technical information using abbreviations. It's so dense in information. And like I said, I've said before, many people who've gone to seminary and pastors, many people are not really able to understand and read the apparatus of the Nessel-Aland 28. It does take some work. It takes some practice. But anyways, those are the two editions. And what's happened again is, you've had for the last couple of decades scholars in Germany working on the Editio Critica Maior, the ECM, which they want eventually for this to replace the text that underlies the current handbooks. They published in 1997 the Catholic Epistles, James, 1st and 2nd Peter, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, and Jude. And then this was revised. They came out with a second edition, revised edition in 2013. You can look it up on Amazon and find it there. Apparently, there are current publications of the Book of Acts that are in process, and also the Gospel of John. And they're doing the Gospel of John, apparently, in cooperation with the International Greek New Testament Project. And I'll have a link to a page from the German Bible Society about the Editio Critica Maior, the ECM. They apparently are projecting to complete the entire New Testament by 2030. I read someone else who said 2032. So at least by the early 2030s, so it's 2017 now, so within 13, 14, 15 years, they're hoping that they will have completed this new edition of the modern Greek New Testament. So, I mean, that's amazing in and of itself. There is a major overhaul that is being undertaken right now of the modern critical text of the Greek New Testament. So what was intriguing about the Nessel-Aland 28th edition of 2012 and the UBS 5th edition of 2013 is that for the first time, they incorporated the text from the ECM, the Editio Critica Maior, into the handbook. So NA28 and UBS 5 are the first time that work from the ECM has been incorporated into the handbooks. So just the Catholic epistles reflect this change. So Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Acts, Paul's epistles, Revelation, they are still the same text as was found in the Nessel-Aland 27th edition, but and the UBS 4th edition. But for the Catholic epistles, they adopted the changes from the ECM. So if you happen to be someone who has these handbooks, you can see this. The editors very helpfully tell us exactly what they're doing. So I'm just picking up my blue-colored copy of the Novum Testamentum Graecae, the Nessalon 28th edition, and I'm looking at the English introduction, which is found, I'll read here from page 48, and the paragraph says, the 28th edition of the Nessalon had to accomplish two different tasks. First, the apparatus had to be revised thoroughly to give it more clarity and make it easier to use. Secondly, the text critical insights and decisions resulting from work on the Editio Critica Major of the Greek New Testament had to be incorporated. As a consequence of these alterations, which so far concern only the Catholic letters, the Nessalon has, for the first time in its history, a different presentation for different parts of the text. The Catholic letters were revised according to a fundamentally new concept, which in the long run will be adopted for the entire edition. The revision of the remaining texts was confined to a thorough inspection and rearrangement of the apparatus, while the basic structure was left untouched. So they tell you this is what they did. Here's the preface to the United Bible Society's fifth revised edition. And it says, let's see, this is the opening paragraph. It says the fifth edition of the UBS Greek New Testament is essentially a further revision of the fourth edition in which important corrections and additions have been made. Then the second full paragraph, it says, in the case of the Catholic letters, a fundamentally new approach has been followed. For this part of the New Testament, the Editio Critica Major, ECM, is already available. The ECM represents a new level of scientific research on the text and offers a text newly established on this basis. These new insights and results had to be incorporated into the present edition, especially since they are also included in the 28th edition of the Nessalon Novum Testamentum Graecae, with which the Greek New Testament continues to share an identical text. For this reason, the text of the Catholic letters was taken over from the Editio Critica Major, and the apparatus was reconstructed on the basis of this text. A certain inconsistency in the fifth edition could not be avoided because of the wish to transfer the achievements made in the context of the ECM to the hand editions. The text of the remaining New Testament writings will remain unchanged until progress with the ECM provides the material and knowledge needed for a sustainable revision of each part in turn. So, these current editions, NA28, UBS5, are incorporating the ECM into the Catholic letters, and the plan is eventually to have the ECM text replace the other parts of the New Testament. I'm doubting that they'll wait until 2030 to have the Nessalon 29th and the UBS 6th edition. It'll maybe when Acts and John are finished, they'll put out an NA29 and a UBS 6 that incorporate the changes in Acts and John, and then maybe eventually in 2030, the rest of the New Testament. I don't know what their plan is exactly. They may not know. They may be kind of doing it as they go along. So Peter Gurry discusses both in his article and in the Reform Forum podcast, some of the significant changes that have been made in with regard to the text of the Catholic epistles in the new handbooks. And he points to a couple things. I'm gonna make mention of three things that are significant changes. First of all, the text is altered in the Catholic epistles at least 33 places. And so if you have, again, the Nestle Lawn 28th edition, the blue cover, you can look on pages 50 and 51, and the editors have very helpfully provided a list of the verses in the Nestle Lawn 28th that differ from the modern critical text as it was printed in the Nestle Lawn 27th edition. And so it lists, for example, from the book of James, James 1:20, James 2:3, James 2:4, James 2:15, James 4:10. And then it does the same listing changes in 1 Peter and 2 Peter and 1 John, 2 John. In 3 John, there's one change in 3 John 4. In Jude, three changes, Jude 5, Jude 18, and another change in Jude 18. They also have, by the way, at the bottom of page 51, it says, the reconstructed text of the Catholic letters reflects the second edition of the ECM in one further respect. The passages for which the editors had to leave open the decision as to which of the variants is the initial text are specially marked. Let me just pause on that for a second. So the first point is there are changes in at least 33 places. I say at least 33 because Peter Gurry in his article and in the Reform Forum podcast said 34. I actually emailed him and asked him about that. And there is another verse in the ECM that he lists as a change that's not one of the 33 that's mentioned in the Nestle Lawn 28th edition on pages 50 and 51. That's another story. So most of these changes are relatively minor, for lack of a better term. I hate to say that because, of course, I'm coming from the perspective of believing in the plenary verbal inspiration of Scripture. So every jot, every tittle, every letter, every word is important. So in some sense, there's not really any minor changes when it comes to the text of the Bible. But as changes made in modern critical texts go, the changes are minor, and I'm just most of them. So I'm looking, for example, at the Jude 18. In the Nestle Lawn 28th, one of the differences in it is that it omits the clause hati that appeared in Nestle Lawn 28. And also in verse 18 of Jude 18, the 28th edition omits the relative pronoun to. The changes are minor, so most things wouldn't be reflected in a vernacular translation. You wouldn't see it. You wouldn't note it. There are, however, two significant textual changes in the Nestle Lawn 28th edition from the NA 27. The first of these is in the book of Jude. It's in Jude chapter 5. Where in the NA 28 and the UBS 5th edition, based on the Editio Critica Major, which was created by the coherence-based genealogical method, it now reads Jesus rather than Lord. So if I pick up the King James Version and I look in Jude 5, it reads in the King James Version, I will therefore put you in remembrance, though ye once knew this, how that the Lord, having saved the people out of the land of Egypt, afterward destroyed them that believed not. Now, instead of Kurios, instead of a Lord, the modern critical text reads Jesus there, how that Jesus, having saved the people out of the land of Egypt. The second major change, I think, is more theologically significant, more methodologically significant, and it is 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 10. And I discussed this verse sometime back when I was doing some interaction with some material from James White, And I pointed out that the NA28 included conjectural emendations. He disagreed with that. I think eventually he came to realize that he was in error and that does include conjectural emendations. What do I mean by that? It's 2 Peter 3:10. The new modern critical text, based on the ECM, based on the coherence-based genealogical method, includes a negative particle, ook. And so in 2 Peter 3:10 in the King James Version, it says, "But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in the which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. The earth also and the works that are therein shall be burned up." Well, in the modern critical text, going back to the NA27, it had preferred not the verb to burn up, but the verb to be found, will be found. I think the ESV reads, will be exposed. But now, here's the thing that's different. The NA28, they say, instead of that, there should be a negative particle in there. So instead of the earth and the things that are in it, as the ESV says, will be exposed, they're saying it should read, will not be exposed or will not be found. Well, that's pretty theologically significant. Did Peter intend to say that the world and the things in it would eventually be destroyed or that it would not be destroyed? That's very significant. That's not a minor issue. That's an important theological issue. By the way, I was thinking about this, and it certainly, I think, would be a good idea for me eventually to do a Word magazine that focuses just on these two variants. Maybe the one that focuses just on Jude 5, and another Word magazine that focuses just on 2 Peter 3:10. And perhaps I can eventually do that. So the first significant change is these 33 or 34 places where the text has been altered. A second major change is that rather than using brackets as had been used previously in the Nessalon and the UBS handbooks, now in the NA28 UBS 5, for the Catholic letters only, there appear another sign that is looks like a diamond that indicates a disputed passage. Peter Gurry in the Reform Forum podcast said the diamond means the editors formally refrain from any judgment on which reading is original. And he also said that in the Catholic epistles, in the NA27, there were about 30 brackets, but in the NA28, in the Catholic epistles, there are now about 40 diamonds, so about 10 more passages they identified as so disputed that they're unwilling to make a definitive judgment about what the proper text should be. And so Gurry says there is slightly more uncertainty about the text. A third difference, and this is something Gurry didn't point out, but it's there, is that in the Catholic epistles now in the NA28, whereas in the NA27, when it's citing the witnesses in the apparatus, it used a Gothic capital M, to indicate the majority text or the Byzantine text. Now in the NA28 and the UBS 5, reflecting the usage in the ECM, you'll see the designation BYZ for Byzantine when they want to indicate that this is the reading of the majority or the Byzantine text. So that's a little introduction, a very simple introduction to the coherence-based genealogical method, and more importantly, how it is now being incorporated into the handbook editions of the modern critical text. So let's move on now. And I want to talk about some positive developments that the use of the CBGM has created with regard, I think, to the defense of the confessional text. And then I'll point to some problems, though, that remain with this method. So first, let's talk about the positive developments. So first off, and this is something Gurry points out in his article, I'd commit it to you, the coherence-based genealogical method has rejected the traditional text types that have been used for so long in academic text criticism. What do I mean by that? Going back all the way to Bengal and then through into the 19th century and up through the 20th century, Westcott and Hort in the 19th century, all the way up to Bruce Metzger in the 20th century, they used what were called text types. So they said, we've got the manuscripts, and they divided them into various families based on supposed similarities of the texts. And so there was an Alexandrian text type that would have included the old Uncials, Sinaiticus Vaticanus, and some of the papyri. And then they would have said, here there are Western manuscripts that were primarily used in Western Europe. And the Western text, for example, the Book of Acts, is notoriously longer than the Alexandrian and even the Byzantine text. There was the Byzantine, which they said was a later, medieval development. Then to their embarrassment, they found their Byzantine readings in the papyri as well. But anyways, there were even those who suggested there was a Caesarean text. And so all of text criticism, modern text criticism, has depended on the idea of text types, text families. But the coherence-based genealogical method has basically rejected the traditional idea of text types. Here's what Peter Gurry says in his article on page 685. He says, the most significant and for that reason controversial development or change with the CBGM is that it has convinced the editors of NA28 UBS 5 to abandon the long-standing notion of manuscript text types. This shift alone could be momentous for the discipline. What's going on behind this? Well, the abandonment of the text types in the CBGM method comes from the fact that they emphasize what they call the texts rather than the manuscripts. And they make a distinction between texts and manuscripts. What do they mean by texts? By texts, they mean the actual words in a book. By manuscripts, they mean the physical copies or artifacts that contain the words that are in a book. And so they're focusing on the text, the words, rather than the artifacts, rather than the manuscripts. And so this means that they may give more weight to texts that are found in manuscripts that are older, and they might devalue texts that are found in manuscripts that are chronologically earlier. So this is a sea change in the way text criticism is done. And what is positive about this, for those of us who defend the confessional text, is that modern scholars, go back to Westcott and Hort, their whole thesis was that the Uncials, Sinaiticus and Vaticanus, were the Alexandrian manuscripts in their work in the 19th century. Westcott and Hort called it the neutral text, showing their bias. It's neutral. They thought it was that the Sinaiticus and Vaticanus represented the original text. And this rejection of text types essentially unravels the presuppositions upon which the work of Westcott and Hort were done. A second positive development, and this is also pointed out by Gurry in his article, is he says the CBGM has resulted in renewed appreciation for the Byzantine text. Now, up front, that sounds contradictory. Didn't we just say a moment ago that the CBGM has rejected text types? Well, then how can you say there's a renewed appreciation for the Byzantine text? And Gurry explains this in a footnote, page 685, footnote 24. He says, we should note that the editors make an exception to their rejection of text types with regard to the Byzantine text. So they reject the other text types, but they acknowledge there is a majority text or a Byzantine text. Gurry also adds, he says, the CBGM has resulted in, quote, a renewed appreciation for the so-called Byzantine text, which dominates the Greek New Testament manuscripts from the 9th century and beyond. The text's form has generally been disparaged by New Testament critics as being late and unreliable, but the CBGM for the Catholic epistles shows that a number of Byzantine witnesses are, in fact, very close to the editor's own reconstructed text. So the CBGM actually says that the Byzantine readings are often the best readings and the favorable readings, and they often prefer Byzantine readings over what used to be called Alexandrian readings or Western readings. So he says, Gurry points out that as a result of the application of the CBGM, about a third of the changes in the handbooks and the Catholic epistles now, in NA28 UBS 5, about a third of the changes are in support of Byzantine readings over readings that were found in witnesses like, now get this, P72, Codex Sinaiticus, Alexandrinus, Vaticanus, and C, Ephraemi Rescriptus. So the CBGM is saying that these so-called later witnesses actually give evidence of an earlier and preferable text than a papyrus like P72 or uncials like Sinaiticus and Vaticanus. This, again, is really a sea change, and it's really a vindication of the antiquity of the majority text or the Byzantine text. So those are some of the positives, but obviously it's not all positive for the coherence-based genealogical method from a confessional text perspective for those of us who defend the Textus Receptus. So I'm going to point out, as you're probably not going to be surprised to find, I'm going to point out some of the problems as I perceive it with the CBGM. And again, I'm not a practitioner of it. I'm not an expert in sort of the technical use of this method, but I see some philosophical, methodological, theological issues with it. So first of all, first of the four is the problem is the use of computer or digital technology to compare witnesses and variants does not preclude human subjectivity in text criticism. So the first problem is some people might think, "Wow, we're using computers. This is a sophisticated scientific method." That these computers can study and analyze these manuscripts and make computations on degrees of agreement among letters and words. They can make these calculations in such a way with such speeds and with such order that humans really can't do or would take them years and years to do. And this is going to create some kind of definitive, scientific result. And the problem with that is that even when you use computers, you cannot preclude the presence of or exclude the presence of human subjectivity. And there's another book that I've been working my way through recently, put out by the Society for Biblical Literature. The book is called Editing the Bible. And one of the articles in there is by Klaus Wachtel, I guess is pronounced, who's also an editor of the German Bible Society. And he has an article in there on the coherence-based genealogical method. And on page 138, he says, the CBGM is a method that helps to control the subjective element in text criticism, but it is clear that other scholars starting from different premises will come to different conclusions. So you can have the database and you can have the computer program, but a human programmed the computer. And if he starts with the assumption that the traditional text is late or spurious, then that's probably going to be the result the computer gives based on the data as it is put into the program. Gurry makes a similar point on page 686 of his article. He says, one of the most frequent issues with the CBGM is understanding exactly how much influence it has had on the editor's text critical judgments. Unfortunately, this question is not one that can be answered by a simple description of the method itself. That is because the results provided by the CBGM, like all text critical data, have to be weighed and interpreted by a human, end quote. And so he's sort of saying on the other end that, okay, I was stressing they're the ones who create the programs and put the data in a particular way. He's saying, okay, once the method produces the data, a human being has to interpret the data. And so you can't exclude the human element. The CBGM is not going to exclude the human element in text criticism, including all the human biases and presuppositions. Second problem with the CBGM from a confessional text perspective, like the rest of modern text criticism, the CBGM is also not exempt from the charge of circular reasoning. So there is a fundamental logical problem with modern text criticism. And that problem is related to the fact that scholars often tend to reach outcomes based on their initial presuppositions. I've talked about Westcott and Hort in the 19th century. Well, they favored the unsealed Sinaiticus and Vaticanus. This was their great neutral text. And so any reading that they found that agreed with Sinaiticus and Vaticanus, they said, well, this is obviously authentic. This is original. While any reading they found that deviated from Sinaiticus and Vaticanus, they said, this must be late. It's spurious. It's a harmonization. It's inauthentic. Anyway, they were following circular reasoning. They had their basic presupposition, and then they interpreted the data based on their original presupposition. Although the coherence-based genealogical method has abandoned the traditional text types, the scholars using the method, as Gurry has already pointed out, they still have their presuppositions. And with regard to this whole idea of, I think it's an interesting critique of the modern critical method, sort of a logical critique. I would commend the little booklet. It's titled Logical Criticisms of Textual Criticism. It was written several years ago by the Reformed philosopher Gordon Clark. It's a very short book, and Clark doesn't claim to be an expert on text criticism, but just in really it's kind of an article or essay length booklet. He points out, he gives specific examples, some of the problems and some of the inconsistencies of the reasoning that went into some of the decisions made by modern text critics about which is the text to be preferred. And at one point on page 11 of that booklet, he says that much of textual criticism cannot claim immunity from logical analysis. And I really think that is an on-target observation. A third problem with the coherence-based genealogical method is simply that it continues the restorationist approach to the text of the New Testament, even though it has abandoned as untenable any possibility of recovering the original text. I mentioned this earlier, that they focus on the text as opposed to the manuscripts. But what they're attempting to develop, what the editors are attempting to reach now in the Editio Critica Maior, is not the autograph. And this is something I think that a lot of people, again, evangelicals, reformed, people who've embraced the modern critical text are probably not aware of. And that is the old 19th century, early 20th century through the mid 20th century idea of the goal of text criticism is to uncover the original text or the original autograph. That has been completely abandoned. Modern scholars today say that is an impossible task. We can't do it. They now talk about attempting to reconstruct what they call the initial text. And they're really more interested in studying the historical development of the text. I think now they talk about the best we can do is get it back to maybe what the text was in the year 200. That's about the earliest we can do. None of these people doing modern text criticism are thinking that they can get back to the original hand of Paul or the original hand of Matthew or something like that. Also, with this new method, as we've already pointed out with 2 Peter 3:10, they have given credence to the use of conjectural emendation. That negative particle, ook, does not appear that they've inserted now into 2 Peter 3:10. The text of 2 Peter 3:10 doesn't appear in any extant Greek manuscript. It only appears in some versional evidence in the Coptic, Sahidic Coptic, and the Syriac. Doesn't appear in any Greek manuscripts, and yet there it is now in the NA 28. So again, this has been applied so far to the Catholic epistles, and there's a big question mark. How is it going to be applied in the rest of the New Testament? Are there going to be conjectural emendations like 2 Peter 3:10 that are now going to appear in the book of Acts, in John, in the Gospels, in Paul's letters, in Revelation? What is yet to come as the Editio Critica Maior is completed, and then as that text is incorporated into the handbooks? And then we've got the question as well as to how this will be incorporated into translations, vernacular translations, whether in German, French, Spanish, or in English. Will the Editio Critica Maior text be incorporated in the popular translations? We're already seeing the impact of it. If you look at the ESV, or what is now called the CSB, the Christian Standard Bible, which used to be the Holman Christian Standard Bible, they've already adopted the reading Jesus in Jude 5 rather than Lord. And I don't know yet of any modern translation that has adopted the negative particle, and it says the earth and things in it will not be exposed or not be dissolved or not be burned up. But I think it's only a matter of time before we're going to see vernacular translations that are going to adopt it, because that's the reading that's there in the NA 28 in the UBS 5th edition. And again, we've got the question of, well, what's coming in Acts and John? How is this going to alter, again, not just the scholar's text that's read by pastors and theologians and students, But how is this going to affect the Bible that is read, that is preached, that is devotionally studied? So that's a really important practical question and implication of the adoption of this method. So the fourth problem, the esoteric CBGM method is being used by only a very small number of scholars, primarily in one German academic institute at Münster. So the text of the Bible, has been essentially taken out of the hands of the church, and it's been placed in the hands of the academy. Not just that, but into the hands of a very small number of persons who are there in Germany primarily, working on the Editio Critica Major. What do we know about these persons? What do we know about their confessional views? Are they approaching this just as an academic study? Is that really what the Christian scriptures are about? And isn't it always going to be true that in academic circles, they're always attempting to edit, to change? That's the nature of academic study. Solomon, I'm preaching through Ecclesiastes right now on Sunday mornings at Christ Reformed, and I've read a couple times Ecclesiastes 12:12, which says, "Of making many books, there is no end." And we could paraphrase that, "Of making many editions of the new and improved modern critical text, there is no end." And so this is the thing. If you have embraced the modern critical text, you have embraced a text that will never be fixed, it will never be stable, and you're embracing a text that's being created by academicians and persons who are not committed to providing for the church a stable, fixed text that can be used confessionally, that can be the same from generation to generation, that can be used in preaching, teaching consistently over generations, that can be used as proof texts in confessions of faith. We have given up on having a fixed, a stable Bible. And do you think that it's going to be over when the Editio Critica Major is completed in the 2030s? Of course not. There's going to be, after that, there's going to be another method that's going to be applied, and there are going to be other changes, and there are going to be other additions and adjustments. What does this do in the long run for the idea of the authority of the Bible, the stability of the Bible, the sufficiency of the scriptures? And this is something I've addressed many times in these podcasts related to this, but it's an approach that does not take into consideration the providential preservation of the scriptures. It doesn't think in terms of, this is a problem in general with the Reconstructionist model. It says we can use scientific methods to reconstruct a lost text, and it doesn't take into consideration the idea that God has, as our confession says in chapter 1, Westminster Confession of Faith, Second London Baptist Confession of Faith, that God has kept his word pure and entire in all ages. So again, this is really a huge sea change that's happening. There was the 19th century Westcott and Hort challenged the reign of the Textus Receptus. We go into the 20th century. Bruce Metzger was very influential in popularizing the modern critical text and seeing it have an impact on translations, particularly English translations. Now we're in the 21st century, and this is a major development, a major innovation, I think, about which many people are unaware. And again, I'm thankful for Peter Gurry for his work in helping to interpret and explain this for English-speaking people. And I hope that it will maybe give people pause about the commitment that they have made to the modern critical text as opposed to the traditional text, that is the Masoretic text of the Hebrew Old Testament and the Textus Receptus of the New Testament. Well, I think that's probably about enough for now. I hope that this overview has been helpful. And as I said, I hope maybe in the future I can do another Word Magazine just looking at Jude 5 and maybe another one just looking at 2 Peter 3:10 to sort of continue the conversation. Perhaps I can do that. I've got some ideas for some other Word Magazines as well. But again, I hope this one has been fruitful and will be helpful. Until the next time that we meet at Word Magazine, take care and God bless.